session number 11214, rule 4.
Colonel Jourdain, Reel 4. We were talking about your period as signalling officer during the attack on Ginchy on the 9th of September 1916. And you were explaining the role of signal officer, and you mentioned the signallers who had to maintain the line. If you could tell us a little bit more about the actual procedure of this, what happened?
Well, it really all boiled down to that there was a line from the battalion headquarters to somewhere in the rear, like support or brigade headquarters, and it meant one single wire which on which everything depended, which went down the sides of a communication trench, and the communication trench was bombarded much the same as the front line, and the bravest people were they were mostly called runners, who went along and mended it, and that was really the whole communication. This one wire going back to whatever it was behind worked off D3 telephones. And that's what signalling amounted to. Of course, quite obviously, you couldn't have people standing on the parapet waving flags or anything like that, because they wouldn't do it twice. And that was a very tricky job, because the chap or chaps who did it, the linesmen, usually had to walk along the top of the trench and were pretty well exposed. And they were probably almost the bravest people in any battalion, I think. And that's all that the signalling officer did, was to try and keep this going. Well, I was only a signalling officer for a matter of a day or something like that.
Just during this attack?
Yes. I'm just about to get this right.
And on that day, do you remember any of the kind of message? You were 100 yards forward of the battalion headquarters.
No, what we were waiting. Waiting for the attack at Ginchy, which was to take place on the afternoon of September the 9th. We were simply, really, in a sense, standing about waiting for it. This is what happened then. I was the signalling officer for a matter of a day or days, but a very short period, because during that short period, the adjutant, who was...
I'll come on to that. But do you remember what kind of messages you were passing down during the attack? Or whether you were able to keep it open?
Well, it was very difficult to keep it open, of course, but the whole thing nearly always developed into some glorious muddle, you see, and there wasn't anything very coherent sent back. I mean, the Ginchy show was going from the existing front line a few hundred yards due east, and everything being going for six. I mean, the whole thing was blown up. But the point is this: I began that short period as signalling officer, and in the middle of it, the adjutant decided to go sick and retired from the war, in fact, and was never seen again. The new commanding officer, this man Fielding, thought I was reasonably intelligent and made me the adjutant on the spot to take over from the man who'd gone. So I was only signalling officer for a very short time until, I suppose, either the beginning or the middle of the battle, the Ginchy show. At any rate, I was made the adjutant.
Do you remember anything actually about the Battle of Ginchy? Is there anything?
No, I don't. I mean, except that I did not go over the top because I was the adjutant and stayed behind. By behind, I mean, was in the front line trench but did not go forward. A fair number of people went forward and did not come back, of course. And this is all a matter almost of hours, not let alone days. And I was then... and remember, I was only 18, was suddenly made adjutant, which was considered a pretty senior position in those days. And I don't know what I did, but I mean, I was presumably with others, hanging about in the front line, while a number of other people got killed, and the thing finished in a shambles, as nearly all these Somme battles did. And after, I forget how long, but not more than 24 hours, we were pulled out and sent right back.
There's two things.
Now you want to ask some questions on that.
I'm surprised that the adjutant was allowed to go home sick. What kind of sickness was it?
Well, of course, there's this good old word, trench fever. Trench fever, I don't know what it is. We all seem to have had trench fever, but you can call it flu and so on. I don't know what it is. But temperatures, diarrhea, and that sort of thing.
Was there some scepticism? From the way you said it, there seems to be some scepticism about this particular illness of the or is that my imagination?
Well, I wonder what you would think if a captain, and you were a subaltern, suddenly said, "I'm ill," in the middle of a battle, and I must go sick. I never saw him again. And Fielding, the CO, this Coast Guard guardsman, who had taken over a few days before, told me I was to be absent on the spot. So because I was the signalling officer, I was there.
So there wasn't a question of keeping him there. He couldn't have been. Couldn't Fielding have just kept him there?
I suppose if anybody says, "I have got," even says, "I have got a temperature," people aren't going to rush around with a thermometer and find out if he really has or not. It means that he's in a state of health, including wind up, which make him wish he was somewhere else than where he was at that moment. But I resent all this because this man was, I don't know, he was a good, bad or indifferent adjutant. He went away in the middle of that battle, just like that, and was never seen again. And like all good adjutants in those days, he got a military cross for it. Now, that's not sour grapes, but it's unfair on the rest of the place, you see, because adjutants did. It's a sort of hangover from the South African War. In the South African War, commanding officers got the CB, adjutants got the DSO. In this war, I suppose these commanding officers got the DSO, and adjutants got the military cross. Well, this fellow got the military cross, which I think was most unfortunate from the point of view of the rest of the gang, who were sweating it out. And he disappeared on whenever it was, September the 8th, I suppose, somewhere like that. And, as I say, was never seen again. And Fielding, who's the new CO, saw I was... fairly useful little boy about the headquarters. You are to be the adjutant, just like that.
It surprises me that he didn't get an older man or a more experienced man. Well, he'd only been out there a month, or well, 2 or 3 months then.
Yes, exactly. But I was there, and I suppose I looked, we hope, in fairly intelligent. But I think the main thing is one happened to be there at that moment in time, and that one knew this, that, and the other. And a signalling officer, of course, is always, almost by definition, close to the adjutant. And one could be de facto an assistant adjutant. In any case, I didn't know one thing from another then, but at any rate, I was told I was to be the adjutant.
Did the adjutant have a specific role during a battle, like a Ginty?
No, except to be commanding officers, I was going to say, almost orderly. If he were a man with some experience, like the one who went away, I mean, he'd been out some time, he could act as staff officer and keep the brigade, mainly, I suppose, keep the brigade informed to the best of his ability on what was happening, because everything was so damn vague. I mean, communications were dreadful. I mean, the one telephone line back was about the only communication there was, and that was the bravest men of the lot were the runners, and people who kept that line more or less in good repair.
But as an inexperienced officer, you, when you were adjutant, not much use at that stage.
I wouldn't have thought so. There's a book there by Fielding which said that he made this boy Jourdain the adjutant who had wisdom beyond his years or something, which I can't quite believe. But the point was, I was there, and I suppose I looked clean about the house or something of that sort.
So you say you were pulled out. Was that of the line? The battalion was pulled out?
No, the battalion was then, after that fiasco, the Ginty show. The battalion pulled out, I think, perhaps that night or the next night, to some point at the back, and it never went in.
Did you see any sign, or in advance of this, on the 15th, was the tanks were used for the first time, did you see any sign of the preparations for that attack, or of
no,
the tanks?
No, we were going, you see, we actually went out, we'll say, I can't remember, September the 6th or 7th, and the first mile or two was walking through appalling mud and shell holes and things. And then suddenly, one saw these things, there were tanks, in fact, coming up, and we knew something was coming. We'd heard this a long time, but never knew quite what. No idea, I mean, what something was going to, which might or might not win the war. And then we suddenly saw these tanks coming up, and we had, of course, we saw at once what they were, that they could get over trenches, that was the whole point. They all had sort of tails with a lot of brushwood and stuff, the idea being they could dump the brushwood in the trenches and get over the trenches. Anyway, that was the tanks going up for the September the 15th show. And we were a guards regiment took over from us, and to our amazement, They had every mortal thing that a battalion should have in the book, like every 15th man had a roll of barbed wire, every 21st man had a pair of wire cutters and curious things like that. And we were absolutely astounded. We were staggering out, absolutely shot to bits, of course. And this was a thing I can never forget, seeing these people coming up, and of course all going to be, most of them, going to be killed on September the 15th.
So when you were out of the line, what were your responsibilities in your new job as an 18-year-old adjutant?
Well, of course, running the order room, primarily.
And how did you go about that?
Relying on the order room sergeant. And that's about right, because I had never run an order room before. But one cottoned on to things pretty quickly at that time. And I was doing that.
What was the function of an orderly room? I know it's a bit basic, but if you could just
explain. It's the battalion office, in effect. The commanding officer's office.
And what sort of functions did it?
Oh, dishing out orders, written or whatever. In normal circumstances, there'd be orders of some sort issued every day, and they got it out. And all the business of returns and communications backwards, as well, rather more than forwards, to the brigade and so on. Brigades always insisted having, I think, a strength return at midday every day to realise what casualties had been like. That kind of thing. And if you were sufficiently senior, the adjutant, who was usually a captain and occasionally a subaltern, was always considered senior to all other subalterns if you were a subaltern. In fact, I think subalterns had to salute the adjutant first thing in the morning, even if you were another subaltern, only once. He was considered somebody of some importance, that's what it amounted to. I'm not saying that I was a choker, I mean a small boy, but still, as we went out of the line, we first of all marched through acres and acres of mud, and then the horses were brought up, the commanding officer's horse, the adjutant's horse, the company commander's horses, and we proceeded further back on our horses. And the commanding officer, being a good coasting guardsman, kept on saying to me, "Boy, you must keep your horse half a horse's length behind mine." Now, can you imagine it, being told to keep an unwilling horse half a horse's length behind the commanding officer's? I've never forgotten that, because it was all I could do to sit on the damn thing without falling off. I mean, the thing is going off bang, not too far up, far off. And that was almost comic opera.
Had you not ridden then before?
I had ridden, of course, at Sandhurst. Fortunately, at Sandhurst, even in those days, they made you ride at 6:30 in the morning. And there were always horses about in an infantry battalion. Because you see, the CO had a horse, second command had a horse, the adjutant had a horse, all four company commanders had a horse. So there's always a certain amount of riding.
But you weren't too good at it?
No, I mean, I was no natural horseman. But what was difficult was when, as I say, the commanding officer wanted me to, believe it or not, in the middle of the battle or some, to ride half a horse's length behind him, when the horse in question always wanted to be level with the other horse, as the horses do. But that's all trivial. But we then, of course, came out of the line and were sort of washing and brushing up and tidying ourselves up and trying to get over this awful nightmare. And we didn't know what was going to happen next. And in point of fact, what did happen next was we went up into Belgium. We did not have any more to do with the Somme.
Now, just one thing we mentioned earlier was that the CO actually brought in a Guards NCO.
Now, that's coming now, you see.
Oh, righto, sorry.
The Guards NCO...
Well, like, could you explain why he was brought in?
No, he wasn't. In this sense, the Guards NCO was considered by the Army, not by us or anything, as a good potential officer. He was made from being a sergeant in the Coldstream Guards to being a second lieutenant in the Connaught Rangers. Heaven only knows why, but I don't think he was a Roman Catholic, which might have been a reason, but he wasn't, I don't think. He was a big, tall man called Booth. That, of course, really set O'Fielding on fire. He'd got a Guards NCO, and he, as a Coldstream Guardsman, could not waste... I've no ill feelings about this at all. He could not waste a Guards NCO. So I can remember him saying, "Boy, I think I must make Booth," I think his name was, "adjutant. Would you really mind, you see?" I said in a lordly way that I didn't mind a bit. I mean, the 5 mob a day was nothing to me, having only about 6 months a day anyway. But anyhow, there were no ill feelings about it, except that I thought it was absolute nonsense that a guard's NCO, particularly because he was a guard's NCO, not an infantryman, should be the best adjutant in the place. Anyhow, Booth was made the adjutant, and I've no doubt he was a good adjutant, and there were no ill feelings. I was thereupon made the signalling officer again, I think, yes, or assistant adjutant or something like that. And there was no ill feeling, no unpleasantness or anything, but the guards' union was fairly strong.
Just a couple of incidents or stories. At one point, there was some. You had a bit of a clash with the fielding about saluting drill. Do you remember that?
What was that? Saluting drill. The CO suddenly said, "I think the officers ought to have be taught to salute properly by the guards' NCO, which we've now got." I nearly exploded, of course, because I didn't think anything of the sort. And once more, it wasn't necessary. And this annoyed people generally a good deal. But it passed over, because nobody took the slightest notice of it. They did this one or two parades like that. I forget whether I was still adjutant or not. I think I must have been at that moment. And then this chap took over as adjutant. And I became the signalling officer.
And another story, you had some controversy over the award of a VC for Private Hughes and his friend, who got field punishment.
That's
true. Could you tell us that story? Because that's quite interesting.
Private Hughes, I don't quite know why, but it may be perfectly bona fide, it was put in for Victoria Cross, presumably on the evidence of one or two people. I had to do the writing up of it. I was still adjutant at the time. And he was put in for Victoria Cross, and he got it. Right. Then one day I was walking round wherever we were, I suppose in the field, where there was a chap, one of our chaps, tied up to the wheel, not of a gun carriage, because we didn't have gun carriage, but some kind of cart. He was literally tied up, because that was part of field punishment in those days. And one of the things I had to look at was anybody who was tied up like that, in case they died or anything. This chap said to me that it was all nonsense. Hughes, that was the man's name, getting the Victoria Cross and nobody else getting it. I was with him at the time. I ought to have got it. It put me in rather an invidious position. I'd had to write up the recommendation. But that's all. I mean, nothing more happened.
Nothing was done.
It would be very difficult, of course, because to get any kind of witnesses to anything of that sort. I don't really know how Hughes, the man's name, did get the Victoria Cross on the basis you have to have six witnesses, I think. But of course, to find six witnesses after any battle of the Somme was a bit tricky.
Was it common for there to be any controversy about awards of major medals amongst the men?
No, I don't think so. Most commanding officers liked to try and get a VC in their battalion. That may be an exaggeration to say that, but that was part of the motivation here, you see. I mean, if you got a chap the VC, it was obviously very good for that battalion, and sort of indirectly to the CO. But I'm not saying the CO got any personal glory out of it. But I had to write the recommendation for this, and I think, as I said, you have to have six witnesses. It's quite difficult to find them after a thing like the Somme. But anyway, it was done. He did get the Victoria Cross. It was given to him by the King. But this other chap may quite well have been. And what his argument was, I was with him at the time.
Now, another incident, while I think you were adjutant, was when an officer came back from leave rather drunk. And through a combination of circumstances, he ended up court-martialed. Could you tell us about that story?
Well, there was a man. Did I give his name? I don't know if I did.
No.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. I've just forgotten his name for the moment. He was, I was going to say, a regular militia officer. There are a lot of people in Irish regiments on the special reserve, I mean, who are nearly as good as regulars. At any rate, he had been a second lieutenant in the Connaught Rangers, regular, and became a captain on the special reserve, I think. He was a part of the landed gentry in the west of Ireland, a nice chap, good chap, and drinking, of course, was pretty common in Irishmen and Irish regiments. He came back from leave one night, more or less drunk. Well, now, more or less drunk is not a very heinous crime in the front line or thereabouts. It might have been a heinous crime here or somewhere like that. But he wasn't outrageously drunk. He was merely happily drunk, I'll put it like that. Fielding, I think, mistakenly said, I can remember it now, "Boy, if Lambert is drunk, we must put him under arrest." And like a BF, I agreed with it. I mean, because officially that was the case. He was put under arrest, much to the annoyance and dislike of his brother officers. Somebody had to be sit with him as escort, and we all decided we would not wear our Sam Brown belts, because the chap who's under arrest could not wear his Sam Brown belt, so we, as a union, said we will not wear our Sam Brown belts on this job, and we didn't. At any rate, there was a court-martial, and as I've mentioned before, I was about that high at the time. I was theoretically prosecuting, and the court-martial more or less broke up in disorder, and the accused was acquitted, and that's the end of that story.
So,
but it was partly, I can say this in retrospect, Lambert was one of the Protestant gentry in Western Ireland, an uncommon animal, and Fielding was a Roman Catholic gentleman in England.
Do you think that had something to do
with it? It had a little bit to do with it. I'm not romancing about it, but it had a little bit. Mutually, I should think.
Another just thing is that after the Somme, when you were out of the line, I believe that you got several of the officers from the 3rd Battalion sent out.
Yes.
And including some who had been in the war in 14 or early 50, and that things weren't quite right then. Could you explain exactly?
No,
what
I think was this. Some of these people, chaps, and nothing to do with their choice or anything, had been out in 1914 or 15, or probably 15, and had got wounded or ill or something and went home. They were then at Kinsale, probably, which was the functioning depot, until the Battle of the Somme. They were not, obviously they were not at the Battle of the Somme itself. They were sent out as reinforcements immediately after it. I mean, the people came to us. The war by then was a very different show to what it had been earlier on. And quite a number of them seemed to disappear again fairly quickly. After that, they didn't think the war was quite their cup of tea. And it's only human nature. I'm not being horrid about it. That's true. And very few of them stayed on. They managed to, they disappeared. I mean,
how would people do this? How would they disappear? What sort of avenues would they go into? Because they wouldn't...
they can't just say, I'm going home. I mean, anything like that. No, they could... I imagine it's fairly easy to develop trench fever and occasionally odd jobs. I mean, there was one chap, not one of those, I think, who was employed for most of the war out there in salvaging bully beef tins and getting the solder out of them. You know, curious sidelines like that, which kept them alive. No, these people, they seem to come and then disappear quite quickly.
Do you think, would you have been allowed to work a sideline like that? I mean, as a junior officer, I mean, these were older men.
These were older men,
pre-war
yes.
Regulars, I should imagine, most of them.
No, there's an awful lot of special reserve in Irish regiments, and they're mostly that.
Would you have been allowed to find a job like that, or to... Do you think they'd have been as...
Well, I was very lucky myself in having legitimate jobs, you see. You'll come to it as we go along. I mean... brigade intelligence officer and things like that, but they were more connected with the front line than some of these other things. I think that quite obviously people who'd been out in 1914-15 and gone home wounded, ill, sick or something, found the war pretty horrendous when they came back to it, unfortunately, a year or two afterwards, and they didn't like it.
Now, how long were you adjutant before you were replaced by this ex-Guards NCO and now officer?
Oh, some relatively short period, from the middle of the Battle of the Somme until probably about Christmas of that. I'm not quite sure, but I mean something like that. And but I was knocking around battalion headquarters then as intelligence officer or something, yes.
So you stayed, you didn't go to back to... You didn't
no,
go to
I did
company.
Not go back to a company.
Do you remember anything? Well, you said you'd moved to Belgium. Which part? To the Ypres?
Yes, we went straight up from the Somme to... I'm trying to think. It's a place south of Ypres. Wichit. Messines is the word I'm trying to think of. There was a battle of Messines in 1917. And we went straight from the Somme to the jumping-off place... for that battle. I mean, we were in the front line. The front line, of course, after the Somme was very quiet. But it was curious because it was all very damp and wet there, and the trenches were hardly trenches. I mean, you more or less stood with a wall in front of you. But it was quiet. I mean, the casualties were negligible. I mean, there were casualties, but there weren't anything much.
And at this time you were signalling officer?
I'm just wondering what I was doing. I must have been doing signalling officer, yes, that's right. Because... this is the winter of 1617, or the late winter of 1617, and we stayed there certainly until the Battle of Messines in June 1917.
How did the weather conditions affect you during that winter? Because it was quite a tough winter, wasn't it?
Not really, I don't think, no. Anything better than the Somme, you see. The Somme was a tremendous amount of mud down there, and up here, and it was on the frontier between France and Belgium, there was a lot of dampness. I mean, trenches tended to be about that deep with a wall in front of them and so on, and the front generally was fairly quiet. And this is the thing that mattered. Every now and again, battalions or brigades, and certainly battalions, were told, you must do a raid. And most commanding officers liked their battalion to do a raid. A raid meant going over and collecting what was called an identification, which means one prisoner, to prove who was the people opposite. One would have thought there were better ways of doing it than that, because practically every raid I've heard of always involved a disproportionate number of casualties for what they got out of it. And there were occasional raids, the battalions seemed to take it in turns and so on, and it affected perhaps three or four officers, not more than that. But of the three or four officers, good bet that two would be killed. And what? They might or might not get one prisoner. And the one prisoner would obviously be an identification as to who was opposite, but you'd have thought there were better ways than that. Much the best way of getting an identification is to offer a military cross to somebody who will go out at night with one or two and try and snaffle somebody in a German outpost, and the casualties would be negligible. But a raid, which is a pre-cooked thing with bombardments and Lord knows what all, nearly always involved a number of casualties. And I can see, to this day, certainly three officers lined up in the order room being told by Fielding that they were going to go on a raid next week. And one felt a proper Charlie there, because you knew you were not going on the raid next week, and they were. And the odds are they would not come back. And about two out of the three, or whatever it was, did not come back. And it was this getting identifications was every commanding officer's dream, because that did him a lot of good with the brigade, to get an identification. But surely there were better ways than that.
Now, do you remember that you were involved in the Battle of Messines as a brigade forward signal officer? Do you remember any of the preparations that went on before the battle? Because it was quite well prepared, that battle.
You know, the Battle of Messines depended on, I think it was 30 or 36 mines under the German lines going off simultaneously at 10 minutes past 3 on June the 7th, 1917, which I believe could be heard in places like this, and even in Oxford, I think, too. But I was given a job with about 30 signalers from various battalions to go up some mine shaft directly the mines had blown up, and which would take me under our own front line, which was by then expected to be bombarded by the enemy, you see, and come up the other side of it like that, and then go and do some signalling and so forth on the other side. But it worked out quite well. I did do just that. I dressed myself up very carefully and polished my Sam Brown belt to be on parade at 10 minutes past 3 on June the 7th, 1917. And I went up the mines all went up. I didn't see them going up because I was somewhere on the ground. Other people saw them from hills back.
What was it like? Did it have an effect?
It like a minor earthquake. The whole ground shook. But I believe you could hear it in southern England. Or not hear it, I suppose feel it. But anyhow, I had to go along underneath a horizontal trench, which had been a thing for mining under the German lines, and along this thing, and then come up, and then I had about 40 signalers from the whole brigade to do something or other. I can't quite remember what, but all I do remember was that one went along this horizontal thing under the front line, came up a mine shaft like that, came up vertically up this thing. I forget how one did get up it, one did, got to the top, where there had, which was apparently a battalion headquarters, where there had been